From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the debate over guns is again in full swing after the Orlando massacre. President Obama's called for tighter gun laws, including reinstating an expired ban on assault weapons. The National Rifle Association says new restrictions would not have prevented the attack. Well, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd took this up when he visited a gun shop near Orlando and spoke to its owner.
Mark Villafane shared his thoughts about the Orlando attack on Facebook, like so many people do after a tragedy.
What happened with this mass shooting here in my hometown town of Orlando is a tragedy, but it has nothing to do with guns as much as 9/11 had nothing to do with planes.
Villafane is the owner of the Guns and Ammo Training Academy outside of Orlando. He's reading to me from his phone inside an empty classroom. It's where this devout Christian teaches a course that you have to take if you want to legally carry a concealed weapon in Florida.
I carry my firearm not to protect myself, but to protect the sheep around me. I train so if I have to kill the wolves, I don't hurt any sheep. Let us pray, unite, and prepare to defend.
What kind of reaction did you get there?
A lot of confusion. How you can go to church 2 times a week, but also be prepared to defend yourself.
I want to ask you, you mentioned the 9/11 terrorists who had planes. That's quite a different story than a gun, which a lot of people would say is much, much easier to get than an airplane.
Well, it is much easier to get, but it's still an object.
In the debate over guns, this argument comes up a lot. Don't blame the weapon, blame the person who pulled the trigger. And certainly, don't blame the law-abiding gun owner. But in this case, Villafane says it should never have been legal for the Orlando shooter to buy the rifle and semi-automatic handgun that killed 49 people.
How did this guy that was on the FBI watch list get access to buy a gun? I think if you can't fly in a plane because of a watch list, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun.
Now, this gun instructor who believes strongly in the Second Amendment is actually in line with President Obama and Hillary Clinton on this issue. And Donald Trump said today that he'd talk to the NRA about blocking suspected terrorists from buying guns, an effort that has failed so far in Congress. The Orlando shooter had been taken off the watch list by the time he passed a background check and legally bought his guns. Still, gun critics say it should be harder in general to get a weapon. So I asked Villafane to show me how background checks work in Florida. He rustles through a pile of paperwork and finds an application from a customer.
They bought a handgun, so you type in their name,
date of birth, and gender.
So you put all that in. We just press submit.
And about 5 minutes later,
completed. So she got A for an approval. So she's good to go.
Now, in that time, the state ran through databases looking for red flags like past felonies, active warrants, and evidence of being involuntarily committed to a hospital by a judge. But that leaves a lot of people off the list, and sometimes Villafane does his own investigating.
I do little tricks when someone's buying a gun. I'll lean into you really close, not that I want to invade your space, but to smell alcohol, asking how your wife or your spouse is. You tell me, well, I hate that guy. I hope, that shows an issue.
In your opinion, where does this system fall short? What needs to be improved about it?
I would say let us know what's going on with mental health. I mean, are you getting prescribed drugs from 8 different doctors? There's a lot of stuff like that, Mental health's a big issue in this country.
But this does not mean he wants the laws to change significantly after the Orlando shooting, because he says the world is a dangerous place.
Probably half of the concealed weapon people that come for the concealed weapon course, neighbor broke into, the wife was accosted or something happens to that effect. So I see it every day.
So you don't feel like if someone in your family had been in that nightclub that your opinion might change?
I have 20-year-old twin daughters. It wouldn't have made me change at all. I would be angry that they didn't have a firearm to protect themselves because everybody in there that was actually a law-abiding citizen didn't have a firearm. It was a playground for the evil.
And if there's any doubt this is water cooler conversation in Orlando, consider this. As soon as I walk out of Villafane's shop, I run into Will Gonzalez and a co-worker unloading refrigerators from the back of a truck.
Vamos a bajar esta aquí. Entonces, bajamos la otra.
Gonzalez stops me to say hello and says they were just talking about gun laws. They were both shocked to learn the Orlando shooter made more than one trip to the shop where he bought his weapons.
The reality of it is something should flag that some guy that goes out and buys an NAR the first day, the second day he goes out and buys how many rounds, something, that line of event should tell you, it should flag it.
And since it was that easy for the killer,
now it's put me on alert that I now need a gun, because if I'm going to go out there, I'm going to be protected.
Gonzalez says his application to carry a handgun has already been submitted. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Orlando.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this is Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia. Senator, welcome back.
Jeremy, great to be with you. Thanks.
Do you think that there is any possibility that there will be some kind of gun control passing through Congress following this attack if it didn't happen after Virginia Tech or Newtown or San Bernardino or any of the other mass shootings that there have been?
You know, Jeremy, it is the case that we've had such a hard time doing this, but I'm not giving up because we've seen states enact background check measures and other common sense reforms in the aftermath of some of these tragedies. We've seen an American public that is overwhelmingly supportive. Thus far, Congress hasn't listened, but I'm hoping that we will in this case. The shooting, the most horrific, you know, single incidents of gun violence in the history of the United States is about a number of things. I mean, there's an anti-LGBT component to it. Most of the victims were Latinos. The guns that were used were assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. There's a potential connection to ISIL. There's just and maybe a mental health angle as well. There's a lot at stake here, and we should try to do everything we can to learn and improve. But certainly, this is just an additional wake-up call that we need to find solutions to reduce this scourge of gun violence, or we're going to see more and more instances like this. And even in preliminary discussions with colleagues on both sides of the aisle, I detect a little bit of a door opening on this. So we should do all we can and see if we can stop being passive in the face of these horrible crimes.
Well, on the issue of assault weapons, do you think that there would be support to reauthorize the assault weapons ban, which expired more than a decade ago now?
It expired in 2004. I voted to reinstate it in April of 2013, and it only got probably 35 votes. And if you're just asking me as a handicapper now what I would think about it, I would say that the chances of that passing would be slim. I've focused a little more on this issue of the high-capacity magazines. Jeremy, one of the reasons that the assault weapons ban proves difficult is as soon as you define what an assault weapon is statutorily, then gun manufacturers make a modification or two to evade the definition, but the capacity of a magazine is a very much simpler and more straightforward, more enforceable. It looks like the clip that was used in this horrible shooting in Orlando, the guy was using 30-round high-capacity magazines. Usually when these guys are stopped, it's when they're stopping to change out the cartridge. And so if you limit the size of the clips, that's a practical thing you can do that will save lives. And it's also the kind of thing that is much harder to kind of get around and evade than has been shown in the past with the assault weapons ban.
And you expect that Congress will be able to do that in the middle of this election year?
No, you know, it's funny. I would still say that one is tough, but we should do all we can. And it seems like the discussions in the last 2 days have really focused on this issue of the terror watch list and broader background checks. You know, I have a lot of scar tissue on this, and so does my Commonwealth because of the shooting at Virginia Tech in 2007. And what we learned was that there were a lot of things that led to that shooting. There was mental health issues, there was campus security protocol issues, but the deranged young man who was able to purchase the weapons of war that led to these deaths was not eligible to have the weapons because he'd been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous. But weaknesses in the background record check system enabled him to get weapons he was legally prohibited from having. If you close down the gaps in the background record check system, you make people safer. And there's been great research on this in states. Some states that had background check systems abandoned them and their crime rate got worse, and other states who didn't have the system embraced them and their crime rate got better. But I think the thing that is now getting the most attention in the Senate is this question of who should be on the prohibited list, prohibited from owning weapons as a matter of federal law. There's nine categories of individuals that have long been prohibited: felons, those under domestic violence protective orders, if you've been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous. And there's a real move now to add something to that prohibited list for people who are on the terrorism watch list. Now, that only is effective if there's a background record check system that will pick it up. So you need to have a comprehensive background record check system, too. But the sense of if they're going to be prohibited categories of people, those who might be on a terrorism watch list shouldn't be able to get these weapons, that just seems to make common sense to many of us.
Senator Kaine, before I let you go, I've heard your name mentioned as a possible VP candidate this election cycle. Are you being vetted? Do you want to be the vice president?
Jeremy, I'm only playing one role with the Hillary Clinton campaign, and that's doing everything I can to help them win Virginia. Virginia is a state that was pretty irrelevant in presidential politics for a long time and is very relevant now. And so that's the only role I'm playing with the campaign, and I just have this feeling if we can help her win Virginia, she'll be president. So that's my highest and best use, and that's the only role I'm playing.
But if asked, you would accept?
I am just focused on the one thing, and that's all I'm doing, and that's all I'm planning to do.
And all this week, we've been talking about science. Yesterday, we heard from the only physicist in Congress. Today, this question: how are we doing at educating young people in the sciences? And especially, how can we get more women and minorities into STEM fields? Shirley Malcolm is Director of Education and Human Resource Programs at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And Shirley Malcolm, how would you describe the state of STEM education in the country today?
I think that right now in the United States, we are in the middle. We're kind of middling. Our science is getting a little bit better, for example, for our middle school students. We're still probably not having it taught as much as we would like to for our elementary students. And our high school students leave high school really not that well prepared to go into a world that is so much grounded in science and technology.
At what age would be the ideal age to really start teaching kids science, if in a perfect world?
Pre-K.
Hmm.
Their minds are totally open. A lot of the things that they are engaged with, you can feed off of their own curiosity. And there are just lots of opportunities that are there to help them understand a lot about the way that the world works.
Another thing that we often hear about STEM education in this country is that girls and minorities are not interested in it or not getting the education that they need to get them interested in it at the same rate as white males. Is that true? You're an African-American female. You obviously got into this field and have risen very high in it. But what do you think?
The first part, girls and minorities are just as interested in science as white males. You look at all of the data that are coming out that look at high school students who might be going to college. They are as likely to be interested in those STEM fields as the white males. The question about whether or not they're getting what they need in order to be able to pursue them is a valid one. In the case of minority students, it relates to the fact that they aren't always in the best schools where the best classes are being offered that offer authentic science practices for them. In the case of girls, they may be in those schools, but they may not be receiving the kind of encouragement that is needed to really help you weather through and soldier on through the study of these fields.
Is that an institutional problem, or is that about individuals making poor decisions about whether to help young girls get into the field?
I think that it's a societal problem. If you still look around, you can see instances of where different groups are being discouraged to go into fields that are mathematically intensive or things like this. And so I do think that every individual has an opportunity when confronted with a student that may be a little bit different from the way that they think about a scientist as looking or an engineer as looking. Every individual has an opportunity to encourage, to support, to teach, to direct, to guide, but not everybody takes advantage of that.
What were the challenges that you faced, and how did you get past them to as a black woman born in Birmingham, Alabama, make it to get your PhD in ecology from Penn State and bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of Washington and master's at UCLA?
Well, that is a long story. I'm a post-Sputnik kid. I'm old enough that I remember very much how exercised the country was after Sputnik was launched, because that somehow meant in people's minds that we were behind. And so all of a sudden, science and mathematics got a lot of attention, whether that attention was in the classroom in terms of sending our faculty members off to professional development and courses, or whether that was on the television or on the radio or in the newspaper. And so I was caught up like everybody else, but we didn't have the same opportunities. We didn't have the same schools. We had segregated schools, and they were poorly resourced. After all, there wasn't an expectation that students who look like me would ever end up going into the sciences. And so I went off to go to college, and I met all of my deficiencies. And so, you know, I came very close to quitting the sciences in my freshman year in college after I confronted chemistry equipment I had never seen before. And so I think that everybody has to kind of get through in those periods and get over those periods.
How did you get through that period?
In that case, I asked for help. I finally asked for help. I got a 9 out of 20 on my first, it was chemistry lab, on my chemistry lab quiz, and a 7 out of 20 on my second one. And I thought, this is not the right direction. So I went to see my TA, who happened to be the only African-American graduate student in the entire department in chemistry at the University of Washington. In that particular case, I asked for help. But I first really had to make the plea that I was not dumb, that I was underprepared. On my next quiz, I got an 18 out of 20, and he was happier than I was. And I think that there are a lot of students who are out there who are in the kind of same situation. They are confronted with things that they have not seen in their earlier educational experiences. And once I was successful, well, you feed off of your success. You say, okay, I can do this. And I think that that's the key to help get students to the point where they can say to themselves that they can do it, but also have the encouragement that shows how that can happen.
What about students who don't have the brain for science? That they may be very smart and they work very hard, but it just doesn't connect when it comes to physics or chemistry or things like that. That they're more into other studies. How do you get through to somebody like that the amount of science that they need to learn at a young age to succeed and be an educated person?
Well, I don't know that I believe that there is a brain for science, in the same way that I don't believe that there's a gene for math. And I do think that it is a matter of how we are taught. It is true that people aren't necessarily going to all have the same interest, but in fact, they can have experiences that can get them to a point where they are at least literate and they can be savvy about science and really be able to look at claims that are being made and say whether or not these are reasonable. And that's really where we've got it, where we need to get everybody. And out of that group of everybody, we want to at least be able to pull some of the individuals into the study and practice of science.
How much science does somebody need to know if they go into a field that is like they're running a restaurant or they're doing something that doesn't deal with science on a daily basis? Why do they need to know and have that education?
Well, see, now that's where I would disagree with you. Someone who is running a restaurant, I really want them to know science. I want them to understand microbes a lot. Because not understanding it can get us both into a lot of trouble, them with the health department and me with my sickness. And I think that we don't think about the amount of science and technology that are all around us and the extent to which they kind of penetrate all of our lives. I mean, you've seen this notion of not needing it because you're going to go in this direction. And I think that may not, in fact, be valid anymore.
So it sounds like then our biggest issue or one of our biggest issues is just getting the right teachers to teach science in an interesting way at a young age so that more people do learn as much as they possibly can in school.
I think that that's part of the answer, to get the right teachers to present things that are relevant and interesting to the students. But I think that we also need a larger society and community that is going to be supportive of those teachers and of those curricula and of those courses of study and those classes. We can sometimes have a little bit of a disconnect between what we think students need to know and communities who aren't really sure that they want students to know those things.
Shirley Malcolm, if there is somebody listening to this who is in their 30s or their 40s and doesn't feel that they got the kind of education that you're talking about that really got them interested and gave them the basic level of science knowledge that they need, what would you suggest that they do at that point?
Well, I think that it's never too late to start cultivating your interest and moving on those interests. There are opportunities for study in two-year institutions. Most places have community colleges that may be nearby. There are online opportunities for people to look at programming and what have you. There are all kinds of interesting things now on YouTube. Some of them better than others. There are things that are available that are on television. There are excellent science books that are available. We actually review a lot of the science books that are, you know, like for popular consumption and say which ones are good and which ones are really worth reading. And I think that those kinds of things where you are able to kind of manage your own learning, to feed your interest, it's never too late for that.
That's Shirley Malcolm, the Director of Education and Human Resources Programs at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Shirley Malcolm, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The second wife of Orlando shooter Omar Mateen has become a focus of the FBI's investigation into Sunday's attack on the Pulse nightclub. And now NPR has confirmed that a grand jury has been convened to look into whether Noor Salman should be charged in connection with the shooting. NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been following all of this. Dina, what's the latest?
Well, law enforcement officials have been looking at inconsistencies in Noor Salman's story. She told investigators, for example, that she tried to talk her husband out of the attack, but then she said she didn't know the attack was going to happen. She had gone with her husband to buy ammunition just days before the attacks, but she didn't report it. And then she said that she had visited the Pulse nightclub with Omar Mateen, but she said she didn't know it was to case the club for an attack. Now officials tell us they don't think that she's a co-conspirator, but they are questioning how much she knew before the attack happened.
It's interesting you say that because there were reports that she visited the club and then knew that he was going to the club on Saturday and tried to stop him. So there's all sorts of reporting around there. What does this mean that a grand jury is looking into this?
Well, grand juries are secret, but our sources say one was convened a couple of days ago. That means that that doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to be charged or that she's seen as a co-conspirator, but it does mean that the FBI thinks it has information that's problematic or potentially criminal. Now, threatening charges is a very common tactic in interrogations, so this might also be part of a bid to get the wife to be more forthcoming. Again, though, it's meaningful that a grand jury is looking at this, and while she is cooperating with officials and they say she has been very helpful, the question the grand jury is looking at is whether she knew enough before the attack happened that she should have called authorities.
And Dina, just to be clear, you know, there are ethical questions, moral questions, but what are the legal questions? I mean, is there a law about telling someone if you think there is a potential attack?
Well, there's gray area here. Mm-hmm. It's not very black and white. But basically, what happens is she could be charged for something like stopping, not telling authorities that she knew a felony was going to be committed. Mm-hmm. It depends on the grand jury. It depends on the evidence they have. But that could be potentially something that she'd be charged with. But again, we don't know that charges are coming. We just know that a grand jury is looking at this.
And Dina, there's also reporting that the shooter called a local television producer while the attack was going on. Now, we know he did dial 911, but this is a local television producer. What do we know there?
Well, he dialed 911 several times, and we know that a 911 dispatcher actually phoned him back one time, too. And we also know from witnesses who were interviewed at the hospital that Mateen had made a number of phone calls while the attack was underway. You'll recall that the shooting started around 2 a.m., and then police didn't break into the building until 3 hours later, around 5 a.m. And during that time, we know from FBI Director James Comey that Mateen had made some phone calls to 911. And witnesses said that they overheard a phone call in which he said he was doing this because of American bombing. And these are his words, apparently, of my country, American bombing of my country. Investigators used to think that meant he had a co-conspirator. Now they think that might have been the call to this television producer or possibly to a friend to say goodbye. This is all information they're trying to piece together to try to get some sort of timeline.
And watching as they do that, NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. Dina, thank you.
You're welcome.
Next week, the United Kingdom is voting in a referendum on whether to stay in the European Union or leave it. There are big fears among economists about what the second largest economy in the EU pulling out would mean. And remember, the EU is still trying to get a handle on the migrant crisis, which brought over 1 million people to Europe, people from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries last year. But earlier this year, the EU made a deal with Turkey to send new migrants coming to Greece back to Turkey and try to stem the flow. Germany has taken in more migrants than any other country in the EU. And joining us now is Emily Haber, who is the State Secretary for the German Ministry of the Interior. She's with us from Berlin. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what is the state of the influx of migrants to Germany right now, especially after this deal between the EU and Turkey?
The influx has dropped significantly. We had four-digit numbers entering Germany and, for that matter, entering Greece every day until January. Numbers dropped a bit when the Western Balkan route was basically closed, but people continued to pour into Greece. After the EU-Turkey agreement of April 4th, the influx of people coming to Greece is double-digit, triple-digit, but never more. So all in all, we do see that the combination of the closure of the Western Balkan route and, more significantly, the agreement between Turkey and the EU has led to what we meant to achieve, and that is a visible reduction of the numbers, a visible reduction of those that are dying on that very hazardous route, and the considerable improvement of the situation for refugees in Turkey.
Is it your goal to get that number of refugees and migrants coming down even lower, or is this a manageable number at this point?
Well, I wouldn't call any number manageable or not manageable. You know that we are opposed to saying that there is a number, that there is a ceiling of people that may be welcomed while others couldn't. What we meant to achieve was we had to see a sizable reduction of the number of people coming, and this we have achieved.
And what about those who are already in Germany? What's the status of those people, and how have they been able to integrate themselves into German society?
That will be a huge challenge in the time to come. In the past year, about 1 million people have come to Germany. In the first semester of 2015, about half of them were from the Western Balkans, and they, of course, have no prospect for getting asylum in Germany. But in the second semester of 2015, about 80 to 90% of those that were coming were from Syria, from Iraq, from Pakistan, and from Afghanistan. Many of them, in particular those from Syria, are entitled to protection. Right now, the protection rate is at about 60 or 59% of all that are coming. So we'll have to integrate a very heterogeneous group of people coming mostly from the Middle East, and they have arrived over a very short period of time. That will confront us with difficulties in getting them integrated, in making them acquire language skills, getting them access to the labor market, but most importantly, make them or encourage them to embrace the values and the principles that modern democracies stand for.
But do you really expect, and I say that in a country where we've got, you know, millions and millions of undocumented immigrants, do you really expect the people who can't gain asylum to leave, or will they just stay in Germany and work under the table?
Well, in the past, we haven't managed to make those return to their countries of origin that had been refused asylum. We'll have to get much better at that. Our message must be those that are entitled to protection will get protection and will be able to stay here. They will have to integrate. But for the rest, those that are not entitled to protection, then they will have to leave the country.
What do you think of the anti-immigrant sentiment that has come up across the European Union to the point in some countries where they have been building walls to keep the migrants out? We spoke with one of your colleagues in Greece who called that appalling and said that's not what Europe should stand for. What do you think of it?
Well, we're certainly against walls. But what we also need to understand is we are confronted at our European external borders with great state fragilities, with instabilities, even civil war. That creates conflicts that makes people want to go away and seek a better future for themselves. And that will remain the case. And that is why Europe in its entirety will have to confront the necessity that it's a responsibility not only to be shouldered by three or five countries, but by all of us. That's point one. Point two is, you're right, we see great animosity, even hostility in some segments of European society against refugees. We also see the contrary. If you remember the pictures that went around the world of people, of volunteers in Germany welcoming refugees.
Right.
It's part of a very complex reality. The influx of refugees, especially in the dimension we've seen, will change societies, and that will instill many with worries, concerns, even fears, what that will mean for them. We'll have to give very good answers for that. And one of the answers is getting integration right, getting the reception management of refugees right, and telling people and proving it that we are able to guarantee for security all the same.
And how do you feel being in Germany, which is the richest country, the country that obviously has so much opportunity that so many people want to come there? Do you feel a sense of responsibility that, you know, unlike a country like Greece, let's say, that you have to take on more of the burden of all of these people who are looking for a safe place to live?
Yes, but that will not eclipse the sense of responsibility that others should have as well. By mid-2015, it was two European countries that were shouldering about 50% of the entire influx. That is really an imbalance, and it cannot be sustainable. You see, we have to explain to the German population as well why we have to take up that responsibility by accepting that this is responsibility that falls onto Germany and perhaps Sweden alone. Then a large segment of our population will say, what about Europe? And what sort of Europe is that makes cherry picking a feasible strategy in one of the greatest migration crises we've faced in our lifetime?
Emily Haber, do you think that we're getting past the point where just about every year, there's a big question being asked around the world about whether the European Union can stay together. We had the debt crisis, which put a lot of strain on the EU, and now the migrant crisis. And people have been asking, do you think these countries really want to be one of this big block of the European Union? Do you think that Europe is going to stay together for the future, or that we're still – there's still a question about the commitment?
I certainly do believe that Europe will stay together. If you look back at spring 2015, I don't believe that in your wildest dreams you would have been able to predict how far we'd come by May 2016, with the Commission putting forward a couple of proposals that amount to a reorganization of the entire refugee and asylum system of the EU. So, yes, we're moving forward, and yes, the crisis is propelling this.
And on that note, there's going to be a vote next week in the United Kingdom about whether to stay or whether to leave the EU. What do you think they should do?
I'm not telling anyone what to do. I am not going to go into that. That's for the UK population to get into. But I can say this, that of course we would like to see the UK to stay. But telling anyone how to vote would be so entirely wrong.
That's Emily Haber, the State Secretary for the German Ministry of the Interior. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
According to new research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the percentage of high school students who are sexually active has been decreasing since 1991. But the National Youth Risk Behavior Survey also shows that among sexually active teens, condom use has also gone down since 2003. And it's estimated that nearly half of pregnancies are unplanned. So health centers from Denver to Texas and beyond are working on the problem. Carrie Goldberg of Here and Now contributor WBUR visited a large clinic in Massachusetts and has this story.
At the Family Health Center of Worcester, staffers have been well-trained to ask the one key question, often and in multiple languages. In Portuguese,
você pretende engravidar no próximo.
And Albanian,
a quem não planta,
and Vietnamese.
Chị có dự định có thêm em bé trong năm tới hay không?
Medical interpreter Annie Nguyen translates.
Do you plan to have a baby within the next year?
Health center staffers ask this just about every time a woman of childbearing age comes in for treatment, even for just a cough. If she says she's not planning to become pregnant, that's an opening for a conversation about birth control options. Nguyen says after just a few months of those conversations, she's seeing a dramatic difference. A
couple years ago, we always see women coming in and it's always an accident. But now, I hardly ever hear an accident anymore. It's something either they plan for or they don't get pregnant anymore because of the education that I got that I'm able to pass on to them.
That education includes training on how to talk about birth control, says prenatal services manager Jennifer Averill Moffitt.
Whereas before, perhaps the counseling was, here are these 12 methods. Choose which one is best for you. Mm-hmm. Now we're saying, here's the most effective method, and here are some other choices. Choose what's best for you.
That most effective method, long-acting birth control. That includes intrauterine devices, or IUDs, and the Nexplanon hormonal implant, a matchstick-sized rod that's implanted in a woman's arm and prevents pregnancy for 3 years. They're not for everyone, but for typical users, both have failure rates of well under 1%, compared to an annual pregnancy rate of 9% for women who take the pill. That's due mainly to user error. Pills are easy to miss, while long-acting methods are set and forget. So why aren't even more women using these long-acting devices? For one thing, IUDs and implants are not always easy and quick to get, particularly for low-income women whose unplanned pregnancy rate is especially high. The Family Health Center of Worcester is making a major effort to change that, with help from a nonprofit called Upstream USA, whose mission is to bring down those barriers.
There are many health centers we work with that are literally not offering IUDs and implants at all, period. So literally 0% of women are getting access to these methods.
Mark Edwards is the co-founder of Upstream USA.
From our point of view, that's unconscionable. I mean, this is a method of contraception which research studies have shown is actually 20 times more effective than the pill in terms of real-world use. And yet, health centers aren't making these methods available. You know, in any other form of medicine, it would just be an outrage.
So Upstream goes into health clinics like the Family Health Center of Worcester and helps them up their birth control game. That means training just about the entire staff on birth control counseling, from the medical assistants and interpreters to the schedulers, says Jennifer Averill Moffitt.
Having a culture shift that says this is important enough that everyone who works in a health center should have this education is huge.
It also means improving back-end work on medical paperwork and billing so the center doesn't lose money on long-acting birth control, and training more medical staff to insert the devices. Plus, there's workflow. A woman who wants an IUD or an implant often has to come back for at least one additional appointment, and that can take weeks. She may not come back, or by the time the appointment rolls around, it may be too late.
That's what happened with me, actually.
Angelica Rodriguez books appointments at the clinic and is a patient there, too. After she went through the Upstream USA training last year, she decided she wanted a Nexplanon arm implant. She booked an appointment to get one.
But the appointment was 1 month after. And then when the appointment came, it was June something, I was already pregnant.
These days, she'd only have to wait a week or so to get long-acting birth control, and Moffitt says the Family Health Center of Worcester will soon have same-day IUD and implant appointments. The clinic doesn't have data yet on whether its Upstream training has cut unintended pregnancy, but she expects the rate to drop, as it has repeatedly in demonstration projects that gave teens and low-income women better access to long-term birth control.
When we give women the choice, hopefully our numbers of unplanned pregnancies can plummet.
Upstream USA is working at sites around the country these days, including a statewide project in Delaware where the unplanned pregnancy rate is 57%. Upstream's budget, funded by donations, has gone from under $2 million last year to over $10 million this year. Co-founder Mark Edwards says he hopes better birth control will become so easy to get that Upstream will become obsolete someday. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.